Hello and welcome to Value Driven Data Science, brought to you by Genevieve Hayes Consulting. I'm Dr. Genevieve Hayes, and today I'm joined by Lauren Pearl to discuss her work in helping startup founders translate their business ideas into financial models. Lauren is a CEO turned CFO who now trains CEOs to work better with financial data. She holds an MBA from NYU's Stern School of Business and is the resident startup finance expert at NYU's Berkeley Center for Entrepreneurship. Lauren, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me, Genevieve. It's great to be with you.
Startups and data science go hand in hand, but usually when people think about how data science can help startups, it's with regard to product development and enhancement. And this is what we've seen in previous episodes of this podcast where I've interviewed startup founders. However, it doesn't matter how great a startup's product is. If the financials are a mess, the business is going to struggle. And this is where data science can also help in the form of financial modeling and analysis. That's something that you help startups with, Lauren, through your own business, Lauren Pearl Consulting. Looking at your LinkedIn profile in preparation for this episode, one thing I found interesting was your reason for why you started your business, stemming from your experiences with your own family business. To begin with, would you be able to share your origin story with our listeners?
Definitely. Yeah. So I did. I grew up in a family business. My father was running a 200-year-old shoe company headquartered in Freeport, Maine in the US. And I grew up in the family working in the business. I rebelled for a couple of years after college and became a software engineer and was a professional musician for a couple of years, but then pretty quickly went straight back to working at the family company and eventually was actually slotted to take it over from my father when he retired. However, I didn't have a formal business education. No one in my family did either. And things seemed to be going wrong with the business. Things were getting kind of wonky, but no one really had the skills to know what exactly was happening and how to fix it. So I went to business school. That's when I left for my MBA at NYU. And I remember sitting in my first accounting class, learning how to read a financial statement, and the sort of very dramatic moment discovering, holy moly, this business is really in trouble. Just like finally seeing it in the data, in the numbers, the hole that we had dug ourselves into as a company. And unfortunately, that business actually went bankrupt before I graduated school. So since then, I've done consulting, I've worked for various startups, and now my consulting practice, I've started my own, is really focused on preventing this issue for other companies. And I've noticed that it's common, right? Entrepreneurs who are excellent at managing, building cool tools, selling, a lot of those folks don't come from a financial background, don't necessarily have the tools to understand what's going on from a numbers perspective, and it gets them into really big trouble. And so my mission is essentially to help them avoid the same fate that my family company suffered.
Firstly, I'd just like to say that you must be the only person in history who ever rebelled by doing software engineering.
Well, I graduated in 2009 and I went to Boston University, which is right next door to MIT. My friends at MIT in 2009, the financial crisis, weren't able to get jobs. The only ones that could went into software engineering. And so I quickly followed suit to the degree I could. I wasn't a very good software engineer, though. I did really basic things. I did a lot of front-end stuff and string web parts together when web parts were a thing.
The other thing I want to pick up on is your comment that a lot of startup founders don't understand financials. My background is in insurance. When I was working in the insurance sector, because most people in that sector come from a financial background, they do tend to understand financials. And then after I left the insurance sector, I was working in a non-insurance organization with a lot of really smart people who were software engineers and lots of data type people. But what was really fascinating was they did not understand even the basics of personal finance.
I'm often fascinated by that same thing you talk about, how really smart people who are running businesses don't have an understanding of how financials connect to what's going on. It is completely possible to run a business and completely not understand finance. People do it all the time. And I think to give those folks a lot of credit, a well-deserved credit, finance is kind of made up, right? When you think about it, finance is sort of a system that we created of accounting for the ways in which we've decided to trade goods. It's a system that's been invented. There's no inherent understanding that you're born with of how finance works. It's like you're not born knowing how the Dewey Decimal System works, again, because it's created. So I like to think about it as it's sort of just a language, right? It's a system that's been created to make sense of how to run businesses. And you really do need to be kind of given the terminology, you know, shown the different concepts and systems in order to get it. Otherwise, why would you know? There's no reason.
What you've described is finance is essentially like a programming language. I mean, you don't inherently know Python or Java or whatever your weapon of choice is. You learn, and there are all these keywords that you learn in order to write whatever your code is, and it gets you whatever outcome you want. And that's basically how you've just described finance. It's just another programming language.
Yeah, I think that's a brilliant comparison because I think it's super true. And actually, it points to something that happens often that I've noticed working with clients, which is often when I work with CEOs who have an engineering background, they get really frustrated with finance because a lot of finance feels antiquated and like it doesn't work the way it should. There's a lot of financial norms, especially in like accounting, you know, compliant accounting, that it doesn't feel like a modern programming language. It feels like an antiquated programming language that could just be so much more efficient if we just changed it. I think it's completely the perfect comparison that it is its own kind of programming language. And sometimes the frustration can even just be, oh, I really don't like this language. You know, I don't like these norms. But it's just what everybody uses, and it would be very hard to completely reinvent the entire thing, even if there might be certain more efficient ways that we could do things sometimes.
Although I'm sure the big accounting consultancies would love it because they'd make massive profits.
Right, transition. All the updates. That's so true.
So I think this is a good segue into today's topic, which is about the benefits of financial modeling for startups. When you talk about financial modeling, what do you actually mean? What financials are you modeling?
Sure. So basically, when we say financial model in the context of startups, we typically mean creating a picture, most times in Excel, of how money moves in and out of the business. It's like the math behind how the business works. A model is a hypothetical forecast where basically you are putting in certain assumptions or inputs around what you think will happen with a business, and it spits out the hypothetical consequences if those inputs are true. In the context of when I teach founders how to build a model, it's often for a business that either doesn't exist yet or doesn't really have a lot of good data on what those inputs actually will be, right? So if you're starting a new company that sells, you know, baseball hats, you have to create a bunch of assumptions around like how many hats you think you're going to sell the first year and how much those hats will cost to make and so on and so forth. But showing all of that in math and taking some good guesses on what those numbers will be lets you then see the consequences of, okay, this is how much money this hats company is probably going to make in its first year. And this is the amount of funding I need to buy enough inventory to get to these numbers and things like that. So for my financial modeling course, again, you're building this model to show you those things, but there's also some context around what a financial model means for a new startup that's not a full-blown business yet. It's also part of sort of the process that investors expect you to undergo when you're starting a business in order to justify getting investment. So it's this picture you're not just creating for yourself, though you definitely are creating it yourself. You get lots of benefits from doing so. You're also creating it for other parties so they can kind of get on board with you and they can check, have the assumptions, do the assumptions that this entrepreneur is making match the reality that as an investor, I think is the case or that I might have information about. And if I agree with these inputs, am I happy with this potential outcome of this startup? And do I want to give it my money because it seems like it's going to be a profitable, good investment? So that's sort of the greater context is it's a tool that's very helpful, but it's also generally part of a process for accessing investment as an early startup that most founders have to go through if they want to take someone else's money to build their startup.
One thing that struck me while you're talking, a few months ago, I interviewed a man called Todd Tresider. Have you ever heard of him?
I've not.
He wrote a book called How Much Money Do I Need to Retire? And in that book, he talks about how you can model how much money you need to retire. And one of the things I found really interesting about that book is that he's talking about how statistics fall apart when you've got a sample size of one, being yourself, and how difficult it is to make a lot of the assumptions because an insurance company that's modeling life insurance, they can make assumptions based on the average for the population. But when you're dealing with an individual, it's very difficult to make assumptions about yourself because if you get them wrong, you've either saved up massively more money than you need to and then you die and it goes off to whoever inherits from you. Or the worst case scenario, you don't save up enough and you don't die and then you end up being poor for the last years of your life. I would imagine that there would be a lot of overlaps between the challenges that are faced in modeling retirement savings for an individual and the challenges faced with modeling financials for a startup that doesn't have data. Is that right?
For certain businesses, you might run into issues of sort of the not enough data, or I think so in the example that you're talking about, you're also talking about a scenario where you've got to make a whole bunch of decisions around how you're going to spend money and earn money. And then your ability to spend money or earn money goes away and you have to live on those savings. And so it's a pretty big bet to make because you can't get better data as you go along about how long you're going to live. And actually, maybe you can, like, that's not quite true because, you know, maybe you learn that you're sick, or maybe at your own age of 60, your grandparents are still alive and you can be like, oh, I'm probably going to live longer than other people. I think this points out a key thing that is helpful for building models of any kind, but especially true in startups, which is you want to build a model to accept changing inputs. So if you build a model where you're just going to build the model and, okay, I've put in some guesses on my inputs and I have this projection of my output, and then you get some funding in your startup and then you never look at it again, that's not a good model. The best models allow you to learn as you execute and then update as you go along so that the output gets increasingly accurate, right? So I'm starting this hats business. I get some money to buy my initial inventory, and then I'm actually running the business, right? I'm selling hats. And I might learn that actually I went to this material supplier to get some of my cloth and it cost 2 times as much as I thought it was going to. I can put that increased cost in my model and then I can make different decisions. Oh, wow, materials were more expensive than I thought. This means I might not be profitable in the first year. Maybe I need to change something else about the business to course correct for that, like cut down my cost of some other material or change the way that I'm creating these hats or sell them for more money or something like that. So I think the line that's true about both of the scenarios of planning for when you get older and for planning for a startup is more data is better, but learning is a way to gather that data. Having a model that allows you to continue to put data in over time as you learn more, prevent some of that from happening.
When you're doing the first iteration of this model, I can understand how you can get some of the assumptions pretty accurate right from the beginning. Like you can just phone that material wholesaler to find out how much it costs for baseball hat fabric. Right. But how do you predict something like demand for your baseball caps when you haven't even made the first baseball cap?
Yeah. So you look for benchmarks is the kind of answer number one. We're lucky to live in a world where lots of people start startups, and lots of them either publish, you know, some work in public and will release some of this data. You'll find like blogs where people talk about their experiences. There's also, so one is like benchmarks of like you or as like you as you can find. Another way is extrapolation from data that's maybe not similar, but where you can compare yourself to it and ramp the input up or down based on your differences. So a good example here might be to say, I know that, I'm trying to think of our baseball example. I know that this other startup that sells beanies had sales that grew like this with this percentage. So I think that mine will grow in that way too. Another way would be to base it on something in the market, like a phenomenon. So you could, for example, project that demand might increase based on the increasing preference for some item, like your demand is equivalent to the market growth. I think the best way, though, if we're doing something like demand, and it's really stepping back, I think it's about asking, what's the most reasonable way to make an assumption? How can I get as close as I can to saying, this is not necessarily correct, but it is a reasonable way to make a good guess? Something like market demand is really hard to know how it's going to play out, but there are certain things that are very accessible about how demand works in a market, right? So, or rather how you grow interest in a product, right? Customer demand is most times generated through marketing. Customers don't just arrive on your doorstep. You entice them to join you, right? So there's activities inherent in that. There's advertising on Facebook. There's doing SEO. There's doing a launch event and having people come to it. And for any one of those activities that you do, there are a certain number of people that will see it, certain number of eyeballs. And then of those eyeballs, a certain number of people who will show some interest. And then of that group, there's a certain number of people who will eventually buy from you, right? So in your model, often the most accurate way to get a picture of this is to model that story, because it connects the work you will do in marketing to the eventual outcome of that market, right? If I spend $1,000 on Facebook ads, I know how much a single click in Facebook costs. I can make a guess about how many clicks will convert because there's some good benchmark data around that for similar products. And so $1,000 means 10 new customers, for example, and making that connection. It's also great because then as you move along as a startup, you can spend that $1,000 on Facebook, see how many customers come, and course correct that demand generation very easily. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that's really cool. One thing I was wondering while you were speaking was, you gave the example of how the baseball cap manufacturer might look at the beanie manufacturer and draw an analogy from it. But I was wondering, how does the baseball cap manufacturer get the financials of the beanie manufacturer? Because the beanie manufacturer is probably not a publicly listed company, so their financials might not be publicly available. But Things like Facebook conversions, I would imagine that data is a lot easier to obtain.
Yeah. When you're working on a model, on a hypothetical sort of picture of what you think the business is going to be, you're basically just working with the best data that you can get. And in fact, it's really good practice for running a full-blown startup, because that will always be the case. You're always just working with the data that you can get, right? You're going to have an amazing conversation this one day because you meet a CEO of some beanie company that you look up to, and they're going to have a, you know, 15-minute call with you, and they might rattle off some data that's really helpful. Oh, okay. You go and you take that and you can put it in your model, right? There's this interesting transition when I think as data people, we go from working in a bigger company to working in a startup. at a bigger company, I think the idea is so often that we have a lot of data to work with, almost too much data, and we're kind of digging in to find certain, glean certain insights. At a startup, you're data starved, and you're essentially trying to leverage whatever data you have to make it more likely the case that you're making a good decision than a bad one. So you start that exercise really with that model, knowing that you're simply trying to get closer and closer and closer to reasonable. And then as you go along, you will have, and in finance, we call these actuals. Actuals are the financial data that's like logged in your accounting software because it's already happened. You'll start to have actuals, and it'll very quickly start to course correct any places where you are really widely off in your initial assumptions.
Another thing that struck me while you were talking is, have you ever heard of Fermi questions?
No.
When I was applying for graduate actuarial positions, everyone got these in their job interviews. They were basically questions where you had to estimate something that you would have no data on whatsoever.
Oh, yes, yes. I've heard this called market sizing questions. They give market sizing questions in case interviews when you become a consultant. Like I was a consultant at Deloitte, but they do it at McKinsey, BCG, all the big places. Yeah, market sizing based on no data.
Yeah, I had one. Yeah. My first job was as a consultant, and the question I got in my job interview was, how many petrol stations are there in Australia?
Yeah. I don't recall what my market sizing question was, and I don't think I could probably perform it anymore if I tried. But yeah, just it's the same concept. You're totally correct that you're trying to think about, okay, I obviously don't know what the actual number is, but there's all this other data in my universe that I have access to. And can I connect these dots such that I can come up with a really reasonable guess based on data I do feel more confident about?
So you mentioned that the main tool you use when you're teaching financial modeling is Excel. Do you just use your straight Excel spreadsheet with formulae in cells, or do you use macros or anything more fancy than that?
Well, so typically when I'm teaching, I actually like to start outside Excel. And listeners might be horrified to learn that I actually encourage my students to start with pen on paper. I know. It sounds terrible, but I will caveat this with that my course is extremely well attended and that there's really high reviews and that I'm not torturing people. The reason we start outside Excel is I find, especially if you don't come from a financial background, but even if you do, when you're looking at an Excel document, I look at them all day, every day. I'm a finance person now. And my first reaction is my eyes glazing over. There's just so much there, right? You can't help it. Even for people who look at spreadsheets every day, there is that moment where you're looking at it and you don't know what's going on. You kind of have to dig in and click around and look at the formulas to figure out, like, how does this work? So when we're trying to learn how to translate the idea of your business into math, I find it's much easier actually to start by just looking at the formulas. Because what we're really trying to do when we build a financial model is we're starting from like a high level equation. Most financial models are projecting profitability. They'll maybe look at cash too, because those are slightly different, but they're looking at how much money will your company make and is it going to make money, right? And the equation for that is super simple. It's just profit is equal to revenue minus costs. What's complicated is that revenue and costs are really complicated to calculate, and you calculate them differently depending on how your business works. And so the very beginning of building a financial model is really about digging into what comprises my business's revenues. What are all the things I'm going to sell? How many customers are going to come in every month? What is the price point of the items? Like, what are the building blocks of revenue? Do I have salespeople? Are there commissions, right? There's these different factors, these different variables. And the same thing for profit. There's sort of a variable tree that you have to create in order to understand how you're going to get to those numbers so you can calculate profit. And so this is where we start on paper, basically by starting with that profit equation and then digging in. And I actually have my students write down the formulas that they're planning to use to calculate each of these variables, right? So if I'm this hat manufacturer, I would ask, how are you going to calculate revenue? Okay, well, I'm selling hats. So the hats are a certain price and I'm going to have certain customers and they're going to buy a certain number of hats. And so my customers times the number of hats they typically buy times the price point they're paying is my revenue, right? But then we can look at that and say, okay, but like, how am I going to know how many customers I'm going to have? More variables, right? So then you circle customers, number of customers, and you say, okay, like, what's the equation for finding the number of customers? And we already have talked about like, oh, maybe I can use certain marketing statistics to think through how I might predict how many customers are going to come in based on, you know, how many people I entice to walk into my store. And so you go in and what you end up with on your written piece of paper are math formulas written in English or whatever language you're using, right? And then you take those and then you're ready to move to Excel, because this is a way where you kind of are able to visually see the building blocks. Most people who are comfortable with very, very basic algebra, addition, multiplication, subtraction, doesn't tend to go much more than that, right? Can look at a piece of paper with those English language formulas written on them and their eyes don't glaze over because they look like how we'd speak about it. And so it's very easy to understand the math behind the business without getting all hung up on like, what's in each of these cells? What are the formulas here? How are we manipulating this? And that's the moment when you have that, you're then ready, right, to move into Excel. And then Excel becomes an exercise in, okay, I know what I'm calculating. How do I organize it? Right? How do I just make this like a tool I can use as opposed to like a theoretical breakdown of how I think about it? So that's what I find is the better process for doing it and leads to better models in the end. Hopefully it's not too painful.
But from a software engineering background, you know, I mean, that same approach would apply really well to developing software.
And honestly, maybe that's where it comes from.
Because that's how I write software. I just come up with a map of it and it makes everything so much easier in the end.
That's really interesting. I think I didn't get deep enough into working with software to realize that was the case. But given the background that I had that led me to doing software, that makes some sense. It's like logic puzzles, kind of.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I took logic as an elective when I was an undergrad, and it was really interesting because logic was offered by the philosophy department. So half of my class were philosophy students and half of them were all maths and computer science students.
Oh, that's really funny. Yeah, I was a philosophy major, so maybe this is not making sense. You're doing some psychoanalysis on me that I'd not realized myself.
So what's the typical background of your clients?
Typically, I work with clients who, most of them don't have a finance background. So I work most times with founders who were previously an engineer. I worked with one client who previously held amazing positions in government and is now building a private company for the first time. I work with one client who was an amazing audio engineer and now has a thriving podcasting company with lots of employees. So it tends to be folks who they grew a business because they were able to do something really amazing. And now they're kind of playing catch up, working on the financial aspects because they've been running the business kind of without that piece on gut instinct. And the business has now grown to the point where that's starting to break down. Very similar, honestly, to the way that my business, my family, was run for so many years.
I would imagine that a lot of them would have the attitude that they're doing this business, but the financials are the responsibility of the accountant that they've hired, or if they've hired a CFO, that person.
Yeah, totally.
How do you make them understand the importance of them understanding financials and not just saying, go do this accountant?
Yeah, it is a working process for getting that exactly right. I really focus on starting with what is most valuable for the client. So I think in any technical field, I feel like this is true, where it's work to understand a new technical topic. And the work has to be worth it, especially if the person doing the work is a super busy CEO who has 15 things that are pulling their attention. And so we normally start with the parts of the business where the CEO is searching for answers. They really need to know more. For example, you know, they're selling and selling and selling and they don't see it. There's no cash in the bank and they don't know what's going on. Or, you know, they are trying to hire, they want to hire, and they have no idea how much money they'll be making next month, and they don't know how to figure that out. So starting with a problem that they have that to them doesn't feel like finance, it's not accounting, it's not technical, it's not nerdy, it's very practical. Giving them those answers and showing them how to think about those things using math and using financial concepts and tools they probably already have and data they probably already have can be a real unlock. And once you get that unlock, I think you're starting kind of that campaign, that internal sort of idea that, oh, this is something useful that can really help me run my business. When finance is an answer to a question they already have, it's a lot more enticing. So for the most part, as a fractional CFO coming in, I'm looking for those opportunities. And then it tends to be kind of like a ball rolling down a hill. Once you know a little bit, it makes you want to learn more. It starts to change the way you think about the business. It starts to get you thinking when you hit another problem, oh, maybe it could be useful here too. And when they're pulling that information from you, that's the good thing. Like, you want that desire to come from them rather than kind of force feeding it. If you force feed it, it always is a chore and it will always continue to be a chore.
I'd imagine, given you say that a lot of your clients are from an engineering background, they'd have above average maths and tech skills. So I would imagine that once they get the need for this, they would catch on to how to do all the calculations very quickly. Is that right?
Oh, yes, definitely. And in fact, I think a lot of them are already doing certain calculations. And when I come to them, I'm simply giving them kind of supplemental information to connect it to financial data. So often engineers, CEOs will be excellent at tracking things like all the customers they've spoken with. They track a lot of stuff, right? Or naturally like numbers. If I can connect those customers to the revenue number on their profit and loss statement, that's really powerful. Yeah, so it really just is about filling in those pictures and showing them why their financial data is relevant to them. I will say oftentimes the disconnect for someone who really loves numbers but doesn't love financial data, it's often that the financial data most businesses have most access to, which is historical financial statements, they're all in the past. So it's hard to do anything with them, right? Like, if you have financial statements are something that a lot of businesses just think about at the end of the year because you need to do them for taxes or for reporting if you have a board or something like this. So they're not used, they're like a way for other people to check up on you, but they're not really something that you can use as CEO to run your business because you care about data for the future. You care about what's going to happen. And you know, for accounting, it's worse than it just being in the past. It's months in the past most times because the accounting data is a high assurance record that takes time to complete. For some businesses, this is not true, but for most businesses, your financial data is like lagging by a month or two because your accounting team needs some days to go through all of your transactions and log them properly. And so it's not just historical, it's late. So in order to really make that data useful, you really need to understand how those past data can be inputs to things that will then help you forecast and make decisions about the future. So sometimes it's that disconnect.
Yeah, what's the data analytics versus data science split? So with data analytics, a lot of that is business intelligence type reporting where you're reporting on the average number of sales by month for the last 2 years or something. Whereas data science is all about taking that data and using that to predict the number of sales by month for the next 2 years that are coming.
Yeah. Same distinction. Exactly.
And the data analytics side, it's useful, but the data science side is what allows you to make decisions about how you're going to behave in the future. And given that, what your clients would need is, and this is coming back to what you said earlier, they need to be able to have data right away, because data about the future that comes 2 years into the future is going to be out of date.
Yeah, that's right. And actually, I think this concept of data and timing is really, really helpful to thinking about your startup and kind of navigating the data you have to work with and the numbers behind your business. Timing often can get confusing in finance because there's so many kinds of, like, the data can change over time, right? And that also, as a CEO, can get really frustrating. Like, oh, my sales number for March was, you know, 100,000, and now it's 150 or 90. Like, what the heck happened? And it's like, well, because it depends on when you pulled that number, and maybe there was some revenue that wasn't recognized that got added. And it can also cause a lot of, like, mistrust for a CEO, especially one that's not comfortable with financial data and the way it works. So these numbers are wrong. Someone's making a mistake. I can't trust it, right? So that's something that definitely happens. So in order to navigate that, you need to have some familiarity with the context around the number that you're pulling, right? And you might need data that points to the future, potentially, like a forecast. And if you have one, you need to know the context in which it was forecasted and what data it's based off of, so that you know how seriously to take it. You need to know what data in your organization is simply real time because of the nature of what it is, right? Certain things just update automatically, like certain marketing analytics might update every night. And you might be able to use those to predict other data that doesn't happen in real time, and then kind of square them once it comes together. The other thing you can look for are data that are, like, leading indicators, right? So data that isn't the data that you're looking for, but is highly correlated with data that you would love to know. But the leading indicator is going to tell you a couple months in advance what is likely to happen in 2 months. So building kind of a universe of different data points that can give you the key metrics that you need to know as quickly as you need to know them is sort of part of that system you need to build as a startup.
Suppose I'm a client who's attending one of your workshops. I've attended your workshop. I've built this nice, shiny Excel spreadsheet. And now, because I'm a startup CEO, I save that on my computer, and then I go back to doing all those 15 other things that keep me busy. How do I maintain this spreadsheet over time so that it doesn't become out of date? Am I expected to do that, or do I delegate that to one of my staff?
I think that if you are familiar with the way that the model works, it's perfectly fine to have somebody else be in charge of continuing to put the data in. But it's really about, you just need to make sure to look at it. Typically, the way I advise startups to build the model would be that all of your kind of inputs that are static over time, so like benchmarky type input, go in one tab of your Excel. So they're, like, all in one place. And you know, if you're editing anything, that's where the edits go. And then you have a bunch of kind of Excel acrobatics in some of the sheets where all of those data churn into outputs. And then you have your financial forecasts essentially in financial statements. So your profit and loss statement, your balance sheet, and your cash flow statement. And those are outputs. The way that I like to update these models is essentially those outputs should match the same format of your financial statements, that, like, your real financial statements as you operate as a business. And every month you update the columns that represent sort of months in those financial statements with your actuals. Okay, so you have your income statement, your balance sheet, and your cash flow statement. And they have columns for the months. In your first iteration of your model, most of those months are calculations based on your inputs. But if you build your model in a smart way, you can copy paste values over those formulas with actual data from your financial statement. And then the projections of how you're going to do over the course of the year and this sort of thing update automatically, because your model will pull from those values rather than the formula that's generated from your inputs. And so then you get kind of that updated yearly projection. And at the same time, you can look at the values you're getting in comparison to the values you calculated to the, or to the numbers you calculated based on inputs. And you can say, were these numbers similar or were these numbers really different? And if they were really different, you can go back to your inputs tab and say, oh, okay, why were they different? Were some of these assumptions a little off? And dig into, oh yeah, my churn, which is the percentage of customers that leave you every month, turned out that was a lot higher. So maybe you raise that percentage or what have you. And it basically will change the projection for all of the future months to be more in line with the data you're already seeing. So you can outsource that to somebody else. But I do think, especially at the beginning, it's really helpful for a founder to do that themselves, especially if they're not used to thinking about their business in math, because it reinstills those lessons of thinking around the churn is connected to the financial statement, right? You're basically building this really complex web of formulas in your head. And the best end result that you want is some of those things start to help you make like quick decisions because you almost have a sense of these numbers instinctually. And you get to kind of fold them into the business genius that you already have. When you manipulate the model this way, it reinforces those muscles.
It's like if you're building software to automate something, it helps to have actually physically done it manually yourself, because then you understand what you're trying to automate.
Yeah. It's like that, but in reverse, almost like you're trying to review the automation again and again so that when you do perform it manually or you're asked about the process, you know the process super well.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
In addition to teaching your clients how to build these financial models, do you teach how to statistically analyze the outputs, or is that a bit too advanced?
Typically, we don't go into a lot of analysis on my financial modeling course. We do walk into marketing analytics and talking about projecting things based on conversions in order to kind of get the likely outcome, but not a lot of analysis in the financial modeling course.
What do you mean by marketing analytics?
Yeah, so marketing analytics, and we talked about how to make a good guess on customer demand. Marketing analytics is the way you do that. Marketing analytics basically studies how customers move through the process of discovering you to buying your product. There's steps, and we call that a pipeline or a funnel, right? Where customers happen to know about your company, and then some of them will go to learn more, and then some of them will demonstrate buying behaviors, and some of them will actually buy something from you. And the more you know about how those numbers break down, the more accurately you can forecast how many customers are going to come in the door based on how many kind of eyeballs you can buy with your marketing activities.
In addition to the work you're currently doing, you've spent a lot of your career working in and around technology. How do you see technology as being able to help startups and businesses?
Yeah, technology has totally changed the game for starting new companies. Things that used to take an entire team of engineers, you can now just go get a no-code tool and throw together in far less time. And that sort of efficiency is happening all over the place, from, you know, how you do your benefits to even incorporating your business. Lots of things where you used to hire either a full-time person or maybe a third party to do it for you, you can now go buy a tool. What's great about that is it's lowered the barrier to entry to creating a company and like what is required to actually put together the business and start building like the, you know, MVP version of your product, the minimum viable product, to start getting data about if customers even like it. That part can happen much more cheaply. So I think that's kind of the way that I see technology evolving the most from where I sit in supporting founders.
Do you have any thoughts around generative AI tools such as ChatGPT?
To be honest, most of my work goes around like the education piece behind starting a business. And I see lots of ways that AI has made certain things easier and kind of continue to collapse the requirements for starting a company, you know, all of those, the no-code tools and technologies replacing humans and other aspects that didn't necessarily use AI. If you put AI into the mix, those capabilities are even greater. So I expect that that will just continue to shrink what's necessary to just get started. One of the things I think a lot about with AI in the area of startups, not AI startups, because that's a whole thing. AI startups, it's a great place to get funded right now. But as a non-AI startup, trying to make things happen, what AI means to you, while the barrier to entry of doing all the things you need to do to create a business can go down because of AI, I also see a hardship happening, which is that any areas where you're directly competing with big companies, where those big companies can leverage AI, the advantage those big companies have will be even greater. Making the AI better and better is something that big companies are always going to have bigger budget to do. And so I think about especially things like marketing. And I speak about marketing a lot, maybe for a person who's a CFO, but I think marketing just is something that startups really, really have to focus on. Like, customers are really the number one thing that if you're starting a company need to be a big area of focus. So thinking about marketing a lot is a very effective way to spend your time. And in the marketing realm specifically, it's highly, highly competitive to get attention. And this has already been a problem for non-AI reasons, because there's, you know, monopolies that own some of the marketing channels that can kind of price the advertising as and whatever price they want. And we're so inundated with ads these days that as humans, we're really trying to get rid of as much advertising and have this sort of bad taste in our mouth when we see an ad. So all of that is happening. And when you add AI's capability to help people create marketing content or be even better at capturing someone's attention or affecting someone's buying behavior using that AI, you could see where those big companies are just going to have so much advantage in that kind of zero-sum competition game of marketing. And startups have to figure out how they can compete, how they can continue to have customers be aware of them in an environment where AI is, you know, really, really giving bigger companies that advantage.
Have you seen the movie Paranormal Activity?
No, I haven't.
It's one of those really low budget horror movies. It cost $50,000 to make, apparently, and made over $100 million, which gave it, had a bigger return on investment than Avengers Endgame. And yeah, it's not a great film, but it's an incredible film to watch in that seeing how the filmmakers managed to make a effective horror movie with the budget that's probably the cost of a car. And so I think that's the attitude startups need to have. They're not the Marvel Cinematic Universe, but how can they produce the Paranormal Activity version of what they're doing?
Yeah, that and I think, you know, that's that startups needing to be scrappy around these things and doing, like, quote unquote, we call it growth hacking, right? Is that part's nothing new. It's always been the case that corporations have had more marketing dollars to spend than startups. That's always been true. And I think startups will continue to be scrappy. And at the same time, you will find, like, individual startups bucking the norm. But on an overall basis, thinking about what it does to the landscape of companies, I think is where it gets interesting. I think often in startups, we think about exceptionalism a lot. You know, oh, you're going to be the one in 100 that makes it. But sometimes that attributes kind of too much, like, oh, you can do it attitude to the founder. Where as a phenomenon, if there's something in the landscape that just gives bigger companies an inherent disproportionate advantage, it's going to affect the landscape, right? One of the things that happens if you've got, you know, if you're going to give big corporations a really disproportionate advantage, more so than they already have, it changes the shape of the market, right? And we're already seeing this a little bit with startups, with advertising is really challenging right now, and you're seeing fewer business to consumer startups get funded these days, right? Business to consumer means that your customers are average people like you and me. And it's meant to be to separate those kinds of businesses from B2B, business to business, where your customers are other businesses. B2C businesses are fewer now in terms of funded companies because investors have realized it's just so hard to make money doing them because marketing costs have made it prohibitively expensive to pursue that kind of business. And they'd much rather you do a business-to-business company where you can use a different sales technique that kind of gets around the high cost of advertising. So something like AI, if it gives a disproportionate advantage to corporations, I could see it changing that landscape even more, where investment dollars tend not to go towards those small companies that need to compete against the bigger ones.
That's very interesting. I never thought of it that way. What final advice would you give to data scientists looking to create business value from financial data and data in general?
So in general, I think as a data scientist, and I would say just in general as someone who really loves the numbers, my number one advice would be start with the business question first, bring in the data second. And it's an instinct that can be really challenging when you're a numbers person, because I don't know about you, but I get really excited, like digging into an Excel spreadsheet and discovering like a new way to calculate something, or analyzing some data and discovering a trend that I didn't know existed, or like that the numbers itself are interesting to me, but that's not necessarily interesting to the business owner, and it might not be important to the business. And so I would say that if you're trying to create business value, starting first, having really deep conversations with business leaders who have those questions, right? We talked about this a little bit in terms of convincing a CEO who doesn't like numbers that finance is useful. You want them to ask the questions. So, and you want your data to be an answer to a question they already have, because that's what's going to be the most interesting. And the CEO tends to also have the priorities of the business in mind. So if you're answering one of their questions, chances are you're doing something really useful for the business. So that's the biggest advice I would get, is before you go into the rabbit hole of what's really cool and interesting and fascinating, because there's a lot of stuff there, start with a business question and then figure out what data and what analysis is really necessary to get after that. And honestly, say you're working alongside a CEO, if you give them that answer and it's great and it's helpful, there will be the opportunity to dig in deeper, because if it's useful, more data in that area will be useful too.
For listeners who want to learn more about you or get in contact, what can they do?
The best way to find me would either be on LinkedIn or on my website. So I'm Lauren Pearl on LinkedIn, and my website is laurenpearlconsulting.com. And for anyone who's just looking for more tips from a startup CFO, a great place to get that is my newsletter, which you can join either on LinkedIn or on the website.
And I've signed up to that, and I think it's a very interesting newsletter, and I encourage people to sign up for it.
Oh, I'm so glad you're liking it. That's very encouraging.
Anyway, thank you for joining me today, Lauren.
Thank you so much. It's been a real pleasure.
And for those in the audience, thank you for listening. I'm Dr. Genevieve Hayes, and this has been Value Driven Data Science, brought to you by Genevieve Hayes Consulting.